thank you for coming back to listen to another episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast. This episode does come with a trigger warning, however. Suicide is discussed, and especially what happens to those who are left behind. So if this subject is a sensitive one, please take care. Now, my guest, Thomas Brown. Thomas did lose his brother to suicide in 2001, and after a decade of grief, uncertainty, and confusion, he decided he needed to change. In 2012, along with a friend who'd also lost a brother to suicide, they set out on a cross-country bicycle tour for suicide awareness and the healing power of art. We discuss this trip. We discuss Thomas's brother. We discuss what happens after our loved ones are no longer with us. Now, Thomas has created a lot of beauty in his life since the loss of his brother. He spent 3 years as a group facilitator for a local mental health facility, helping others who have lost loved ones to suicide. And in 2015, he launched a podcast called Inner Monologue, a conversational interview show where others shared their journeys of trials and tribulations. Thomas is creating a lot of positive change in this world and is also lifting lots of other people up. But enough of me talking. It's time to hear from Thomas. So here's the very next episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast.
About 6 months before we left on our bike ride, I was in full advertisement mode and I was like handing out flyers. I made little cards to put in coffee shops. I'm exhausted. I got up all morning. I was making cold calls, calling different places about different mental health facilities across the country, getting them to like commit to like seeing us. And then I had to go to work and I was on my way home and I drove past this this coffee shop. And I was like, you know what? I got a stack. I drove right past it. I'd never been there before. And I was like, I got a stack of cards in my car. I'm just going to do a U-turn and I'm going to go back there.
Self-describe. If you had to go to a party or a conference and you had to introduce yourself to a whole bunch of people, how would you do that?
If I was just going to put it as a title, I would say that I'm a self-awareness advocate. You know, I feel like it's kind of hard to like say that because we are all a multitude of things. I think the wheelhouse where I fit in, my primary passion, and it doesn't matter if I'm expressing that through photography, nonfiction writing, or fiction writing, I will always be promoting the importance of knowing who you are.
And why is that important to you?
I think it's the only game in town for the human species. Whether you're a religious person or not, whether you're a political person or not, knowing who you are is the most important thing on this planet. If you don't know who you are, you have the entire world of people telling you who you are and who you should be. And I think it's important. I think the mental health crisis that we are facing in this country, it's not the only thing, because there's not a lot of economic issues that go along with it, but knowing who you are, who am I? Where do I begin? Where do I end? Where does the influence of culture begin? Who am I outside of my country? Who am I outside of my culture? Who am I outside of the religion I was raised in? Who am I outside of the political ideology I was raised in? Who am I outside of my family? Who am I outside of my community? It's very important to know who you are. As if you don't know who you are, there's no way you can know where you're going.
And what's really interesting about that, I think, is that it's really scary sometimes
to like mm-hmm. look at yourself and understand that there are these dark, crusty little crevices, maybe where some little gremlins live, and you sort of have to reconcile those, and it's not fun.
No, it's not. I mean, but anything worth doing can have its moments of strain. I would say that it's not only is it scary, a journey of self-discovery, but it's also very sobering. But also on the other side of that spectrum is that it's never ending. And I don't say that in a way for it to be daunting. Your journey, look, I don't know what happens after we die. Some people think that they have an idea of what, that there's an afterlife or anything. I don't know if we go up into a realm of clouds and angels on that, or if we just fade into the great darkness. I have no idea. All right. But I do know that from cradle to grave, you're always going to be learning new things about yourself if you have an open mind, if you're paying attention. So I think it's like it's awesome that like we're constantly changing. There's no finish line except for like death, where the ego is dissolved and faded away. So if you keep yourself open with each and every new experience, you get the opportunity to learn a little bit more about yourself.
And I'm curious. I use that word so much on this show. I'm like, I'm so curious. I'm sure my listeners are like, good God, we're sick of hearing that. But I am curious, was this something that occupied your mind since you were a child, or how did this happen? Like, how did this come about?
I went to therapy. I think that's, before I die, if I could contribute one thing to humanity, I think it would be to either inspire somebody to do it or to do it myself, but write a curriculum that's all about self-awareness that starts in kindergarten. And like every other class that you take, like math, science, literature, humanities, that each year you go up another skill set. A lot of times when it comes to like Eastern philosophy, philosophy in general, you know, learning how to be introspective, it usually happens when I need a humanities credit for my college degree, and you wander into a philosophy class and then you're hit with some truth. That's one way of doing it. Another way is you suffer a traumatic experience. And after you've circled the drain, if you're one of those people that have to hit rock bottom, you realize that you need to make some changes, and then you go on a journey of self-discovery. So it's just right now, the way that the world is set up, we're not encouraged to go on that journey. And I think it would be really beneficial for us to start that process when we're younger. It might help us deal with like a lot of socially acceptable family traumas just from like family dynamics. It might help us like understand those a little bit better. But for me personally, you know, I was always like a curious person. I don't think anybody should ever give you grief for using the word curious. Being curious is important. If you want to go on a journey of self-discovery, you got to be curious. You got to be willing. You have to like, hey, like here's a door and it goes to a basement and it's dark and damp and spooky down there. But if you want to figure out where the light switch is to like see what's happening in that room down in that basement, you got to be curious enough to go in there no matter how scary it is. So keep using that word. I was always a curious kid, but I had a lot of fear, a lot of codependency issues. I think I inherited some of those through my upbringing, it wasn't like anything horrible that I had gone through, but it wasn't until, you know, I lost my brother to suicide back in 2001. I was 24 years old. Fast forward to like 2007, 2008, 5, 6, 7 years later, I finally found myself in therapy. And it was finding, and I think therapy is kind of like dating. You have to find somebody that that fits you. I was lucky right off the bat. I had somebody that I really trusted, somebody who really knew me, a mentor of sorts that recommended me to this person. And, Kim is a woman's name who helped me. She helped me understand myself. We went on a journey through all of my experiences to why I believe the things that I believe, why I respond in the way that I respond. And she held up a mirror. I think a really good therapist teaches you how to learn yourself. And that's exactly what she did. And I slowly gathered the courage to, you know, deal with my codependency issues, which was a main culprit in a lot of my mental health issues, because I was too afraid to venture out on my own. Like, I needed to have people with me, and it didn't even matter if those people were toxic. So it was a long journey. I wish I could say that I always understood the importance of self-awareness. I'm late to the game. But unfortunately, I think that goes for a lot of us. You know, people can be born with great athletic ability. People can be born with great, like, artistic talent. And some people can be born with a great sense of self. I was not one of those people.
And I was going to ask, in your family, was it just you and your brother? Do you have other siblings?
No, it was just me and Mark. He was 6 years older than I was. So my parents come from a very small town in Kansas. You know, they were born in the late 40s, grew up in the 50s. They both moved out here, and that's when they really met each other. They had known each other as kids, but they didn't hang out. And it wasn't until they were in Phoenix that they started a relationship. So you have two individuals that come from such a simpler, and I don't use this like in a most positive way, but it was, you know, there's not a lot of technology. It's not a giant city. So they didn't have the privilege of experiencing other cultures. And they came out here and they did the best they could in a city that was constantly growing. I live in the Phoenix area. Ever since, what, 89 or 91, when we had the Super Bowl, Phoenix has exploded like a weed, and it has not stopped. It just keeps on growing larger and larger and larger, and just spreading out further and further. And my parents just didn't know how to, they didn't know how to, like, deal with, like, the changing times in a way that probably would have benefited Mark and I. And my brother, being a very bombastic person, he kind of, once he got to the an older age, he kind of expressed his dominance in the family unit, even sometimes being more of a dominant figure than even my parents. And that was something that slowly started to put a divide between him and I, because I was a little bit more carefree and a little bit more, hey man, like, let's have fun. And he's just like, he's very stern and very hard. And he was kind of a know-it-all. And in the end, he really wasn't.
I do feel like, I was just talking about this with someone the other day, that when I was in my teens and early 20s, I 100% felt like I knew it all. I just was like, nobody really needs to tell me anything, because I've got this whole thing figured out and I know everything. And then at this ripe old age that I am, I look back and I think, oh my goodness, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. And so, I mean, I don't know when he started being bombastic and just, you know, acting out or whatever he was doing, but I feel like most teenagers are that way. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. And I've worked with teens for a long time. I think when you're a teenager and you're growing up, part of the coming of age story is testing your bounds of reality. And within that is testing authority. My brother was more bombastic in a charming way. He was a singer. He was kind of like a music snob. He didn't really like any of the music that I was into. I liked a little bit more of a prog rock and stuff like that. And he was like into operas and theater and barbershop quartet and all that. And so as he was growing up in high school and then into college, and he was in a lot of singing groups, he got a lot of validation, adulation, and it totally inflamed his ego. And he was a charming guy and used that power that he was cultivating for not the best moral activities. He became a womanizer, and I didn't agree with his womanizing, but I wasn't going to tell him how to live his life. And I became curious and experimental with cannabis in my youth, and he didn't like that about me. The difference was that I tried to stay out of his business. Hey, you do your thing, you do you, like, just don't have me involved. And he was like, no, not only must you be involved, but you must lie for me when I need you to lie for me. And if you don't, I'm going to throw you under the bus with any type of institution that you might be a part of, or community that you might be a part of, even work, and about your cannabis use. So yeah, it threw a massive divide in us. And so I just kind of like removed myself from my family for the last 2 years of my brother's life.
I'm so sorry about that. I have, you know, a younger sister, and we've certainly been at each other's throats, let's just say, ever since we were kids and, you know, through high school and college. But now we're getting old and decrepit. And in the last little bit, we've kind of reconciled, and it's been really beautiful. I mean, it's been a long time coming, but much needed. And I think those relationships with siblings are some of the most challenging in our lives, because they know exactly where the cuts are and where to pour the mm-hmm. lemon juice so that it hurts with maximum efficiency. And siblings like know where all our secrets are. They know the buttons to push, and they can do it effortlessly, by the way, because they just have that kind of relationship with you. And so I totally get it. The second question I always ask is, did you grow up in a religious household? And I'm curious, because your parents, you know, they're in this small Kansas community. And if so, did it kind of inform the rest of the family?
No, they actually went, and my dad still is a member of the church. They're really progressive. The church that the community that they found here in the Phoenix area is very, very progressive. I am not a Christian. I very, very early in my age, I had way too many questions about the whole God situation. And I'm more agnostic. I wouldn't really say I'm atheist, but I'm kind of like, I always struggle between, like, to me, it like doesn't even matter if it's a supreme being is there. Like, why would it care about anything? Why would it have like a negative opinion about anything that I do if I'm not hurting anybody? So they were always part of a progressive church. And I bring up the fact that I wasn't Christian because in 2006, my brother had been dead for 5 years. My codependency, I was at its peak, but I just knew I needed to break away from the people that I was with, and I needed to do something different. And my parents told me that their minister wanted to walk across the country from Phoenix to Washington, D.C. and talk with people, find people that didn't agree with him, that didn't agree with like the major points of his faith, and talk to those people and try to figure out where they do agree, at what point in their faith do they do have an agreement on, and then build a positive relationship from that. And what I mean, like progressive, like open and affirming to people of different sexual orientation, believing that we should be stewards of the planet, civil rights leaning, believing that there's more than one way to have a relationship with God, meaning that, like, you know, Jews are valid, Hindus are valid, Muslims are valid, that they just choose to have a relationship with God through the Christian ideology. So it was just, and also one of the big ones that I really liked is that recognizing the profound power in secular art, and it's just as important as scripture. Is that, like, they had me at that one as well. So I quit my job. I traded in cannabis for wine for about 5 months. Those Christians really like their, they really love their wine. And I traveled with them, and I actually, the minister had me partner up because he knew that I was a big fan of film and I wanted to go to film school. So he partnered me with a filmmaker that was following them. And I became his kind of like, I became his production assistant, his unpaid production assistant. And it was kind of like having theology on the road and film school on the road. And it was the first time I had ever traveled east of the Mississippi. So I hadn't, as far east as I had ever been in my entire life was Wichita up until that point. So it was a really cool experience, and it was something that I really needed because I always wanted to see the more of the world. You know, I'd been to some of the states in the West, but that was about it. And it really just traveling in this country kind of opens you up to the how diverse and different that this country can be.
Yes, and how gorgeous, and all the different landscapes, and all absolutely. The giant world's giantest, most biggest balls of twine and stuff like that.
Hell yeah.
I mean, this country has so many interesting festivals and celebrations and music festivals and what have you. That journey just sounds seriously profound. And how serendipitous that you're into film and then there's this filmmaker there, and it kind of, the whole thing dovetailed. But I also have to say that, you know, what a leap of faith to just jump off and say, I'm going to do this, you know, go with this and go on this adventure. Cause it sounds, I mean, first of all, it's a lot of walking. And so it sounds a little exhausting to me, but also it sounds like this incredible, almost invitation to adventure. I'm sure you didn't know what each day was going to bring. And, you know, I wanted to just ask because, you reference on your Podmatch page that, you know, your brother committed suicide in 2001.
Yeah.
And then you went on this journey 5 years later, walking on this walking journey. But then you also say that it was about 10 years. So from 2001 is about 10 years until you, well, you had a decade, it says, I'm reading here, of grief, uncertainty, and confusion. And then you decided that you needed to change.
Well,
so
I mean,
how did that happen?
So I had done the walk with my parents' church, and that really opened me up. And when I got back, I still hadn't been in therapy yet. I came back, I was in a really like toxic relationship because of my codependency. I kept going back, and I was with this woman for 7 years. And so I came back, went back into the relationship with her, but I also went to film school. So I was learning a lot more about myself. The relationship came to a head, and I realized that, like, I had some unresolved issues that I needed to deal with. Otherwise, why would I remain in a toxic relationship? And that's when I found Kim and started therapy and going on a journey of self-discovery. So this is like, went on the walk in 2006, film school in 2007, going into therapy in 2008. And then in 2010, I connected with somebody that I had worked with. I had seen him around I worked in a park system at that point, and I had seen him at different like park events where like your park would go to another park and both the after school programs or the summer programs would just like combine. And I had seen him around because I did like a lot of photography. Coordinators would ask me to go to certain events and take pictures of the events taking place. And so they would have you use photos for next year's, the next year's advertising. And I'd always seen this guy around. And it wasn't until he filled in one day, he was covering a shift for somebody that was out of town. And it was the first time that him and I really got to talk to each other and we got along. Fast forward a few months, I get a cryptic Facebook message from him that he was in Nebraska visiting his family and he had broken up with this girlfriend and he was really mopey about it. And he's like, when I get back in town, let's hang out. So we meet up at a coffee shop. And the first thing that I notice is he's reading the second book in Daniel Quinn's Ishmael series called My Ishmael, or the third book in the series. It's a book called My Ishmael. And I was like, oh my God, man, like I'm reading that series too. And so like, that's where our conversation kind of started. And he asked me, you know, like how I found out about the book. I'd actually got it from my therapist, Kim. She started me on this. And the thing about Daniel Quinn is that he promotes self-awareness. He promotes understanding the story and narrative that you come from, to know like your cultural story, your family story, your religious story, and inevitably your personal story. So we just started talking and I told him, you know, about my brother and that I lost my brother to suicide. And, he was really receptive to that and very like, you know, he didn't shy away from a tough conversation. So the coffee shop closed kind of late at night. It was one of those late night ones. I think it closed like at 11:30 or 12. We went over to his house to like, just, you know, we bought more coffee before we left and he's a drummer and he likes music and we were listening to music and he's like, hey man, I got to tell you, I lost my brother to suicide. So that was the first time I had ever met somebody that had lost somebody to suicide. It was in 2010. And so I call him up, like we just started hanging out a lot more. And I called him up and I'm like, hey man, what's your birthday? I sent him a text when I was like, what's your birthday, dude? Cause you have a vibe of my brother, you know, you have some vibes. And he said, my birthday is September 7th, which is the same birthday as my brother. And the park that I was working at that he covered in was the park that my brother worked at for 10 years before he died. And there's like a tree that was planted in his honor with a little plaque outside. So I just thought it was funny. So I meet him. There's another aspect of the story that is really weird. So I start dating this woman. I break up I'm out of that horrible relationship and I start dating this woman and she's got a regular job and stuff, but then she's a pinup for this alternative, expression of beauty pinup site called Suicide Girls. It's just like a way, like, you know, we're edgy. So it's like, you know, girls that have tattoos, piercings, and like, you know, neon blue hair. So I started dating her when I met Zach and hanging out with him. So I jokingly called them my suicide friends. One person is like more of like an edgy expression of art and beauty. And the other one is somebody who had actually lost somebody to suicide. So a few months, we're like in June of 2000, we're in June of 2010. I'm asked by the woman that I'm dating, like, hey, we're going to have a Phoenix community suicide girls party at this local bar in Scottsdale where like all the models can come and some of the fans can come and it's just a way to like hang out. Can you do event photography for the group? We'd really appreciate it. So I was like, yeah, sure. I'm not really like, I don't like to be out at clubs or bars. Like I'll go out from time to time, but I get overstimulated. So I was like, at least I could hide behind the camera and just take a bunch of pictures. I ended up sending Zach a text and I was like, hey man, come hang out with me. I need to hang out with somebody. I need a homie to hang out with. This is a weird scene. So he comes over and hangs out and, you know, I was really happy in the relationship I was with the new woman. I love the fact that like I had made a connection with somebody like Zach who had also lost somebody to suicide. It was the first time I ever had that connection, but there was something gnawing at me. Like I just needed to, I still needed to change. And so I tell Zach for the first time about my adventure with the Christians walking from Phoenix to DC. And I was like, I really want to do something like that again. I really, really want to do something like that again. And he's like, well, why don't we do it for our brothers, but we'll do it for, we do it for like suicide awareness and we do it in honor of our brothers. I was like, that's a brilliant idea. Let's do it. He's like, but I'm not going to walk across the country. I like bicycles. Let's ride our bikes across the country. And I thought about it. I was like, hey, like you can cover more mileage in a single day. And if you want to see that, I mean, I looked at, instead of looking at that and being like, you could finish quicker, I looked at it as, well, we can go to more places, so let's stay out longer. And so we wrestled with the idea for a little bit. This is in June, summer 2010. And then the woman that I was dating, her and I broke up in February 2011. And the next day I called Zach. I was like, hey, remember that bike ride idea? I don't have any obligations keeping me. I don't have any people keeping me here. Let's do it. And so from that point, we had 13 months to prepare and plan and raise money and get the word out. And March 1st, 2012, we started our bike ride at the northern edge of the Golden Gate Bridge and combined rode our bikes 7,000 miles. I knew after I met Zach that there was going to be something more to our relationship. The fact that like he had, you know, he had the same birthday as my brother. He had also lost his brother to suicide. But then that we come up with this idea to ride our bikes across the country for suicide awareness while at a suicide girls community party, it was just like, there was too many cosmic giggles. And I knew that there was much more, so much more to our relationship than hanging out, playing basketball, drinking beers, and trying to talk to women, you know? I'd always known that there was some reason. And it wasn't until that night that I was like, in June of 2010, like, this is why we met. This is what we have to do. And we ended up riding our bikes across the country.
How long did that take?
We scheduled 7 months. Originally, when we started, we wanted to raise enough money to buy a van, like a beat up van, and hire somebody to drive it for us. Because being in film school, I wanted to do a documentary. So I wanted to hire somebody that was, you know, competent in knowing how to get around new places, could take care of us if we needed, you know, when we needed water and food, but would also videotape while we were doing speaking engagements and talking with different communities around the country. Cause we set up like a ton of events sponsored by mental health facilities where we talked with people that lost loved ones to suicide, talked to therapists, talked to activists, talked to lawmakers. We didn't raise the money that we needed to buy a van, even a beat up van, let alone pay somebody to travel with us for 7 months. So we just had a lot of piss and vinegar and we're like, well, we're just going to ride our bikes. All right. We don't need a support vehicle. Meanwhile, I have a truck at home that was totally capable of being a support vehicle. So we rented a car. We drove it out to San Francisco and once we had a place to start from, and we actually got the Coast Guard in Sausalito, who part of their beat is San Francisco Bay. And they're the first ones on site when people end their lives by jumping from the bridge. So they took us in and then they drove us up to the top of the bridge. And they were the ones that like said good journey and sent us on our way. But we drove out there in a rented van, had to get the van back to the airport and then travel the night before our bike ride, ride our bikes like 10 miles through San Francisco, through all those hills. And you know, Phoenix is nothing compared to San Francisco, just in topography alone. The hills in San Francisco are crazy. So once we, California beat the hell out of us with all the mountains and hills that we had to ride through, we're like, look, we need to be able to get to our events on time. We can't just show up and do an event when we get to town. There, the events are scheduled. We need to be at this, these places at a certain time. So, you know, 7,000 miles across the country is kind of like doing a round trip across the country. It's not a straight line. Like, we did a, like a W around the country. We just like went everywhere. And so I was like, look, when we walked across the country, we had two walking teams, and we had, they had an RV. And since I was a one of the filmmakers, I had a Jeep. So what I would do is I would leapfrog the walkers like by like 5 miles, walk to them with my camera gear, and then walk backwards with them interviewing them. Or I would set up my camera and have them walk past, and I'd get some B-roll. I was like, we had a support vehicle, and one team would walk in the morning and another team would walk at the end of the, at the, in the afternoon. And it was a team effort. We can do that with our, with what we're doing. And if one of us gets injured, it won't stop us from continuing. So when we got back to Arizona, I just got my truck. I kind of retrofitted it. We got like something like a bike rack for the back of the truck. So when one person, when one of us would drive while the other person rode their bike. And so we did that from Arizona all the way. We did 21 states. We did California with minimal support. And once we got to Arizona, we went all out and just like had used the support vehicle. So and a typical day of riding would be, if you're driving, you know, you're doing like the administration work for the team, just on your cell phone, which is the beauty of smartphones, while the other person is riding. But you have to like go along the route with them. In the West, it wasn't until we got to Georgia that we had, you kind of had to follow, you just put on your hazards and you follow the person. Cause in Georgia, for some reason, and all the up the rest of the East Coast, there weren't shoulders to drive on, to ride your bike on. Where out here, massive shoulders you could ride on, and you're pretty safe.
I do want to just say as an aside, I'm super jealous you went to film school, because that's always been on my bucket list. And so I'm a little jelly over here, just to let you know. So I have to ask you the nugget of my podcast, which is, you know, I ask everybody who appears on the show, I would love to hear, or for you to share a story of something magical or miraculous that's happened in your life. Maybe something inexplicable, maybe something mysterious, something that maybe we don't have language for yet. Something that's happened in your life that you classify as magical. I'd love to hear it, whatever you have to share.
Okay. I could tell you about the day that my brother died, because there was some magic that happened in there that was like the universe telling me that something was wrong. There was like a tremor in the force. But maybe if I ever come back, I could share that story. I want to share something from the bike ride, which was for him, but it was still something magical. And this might seem mundane to people. The main message of my book is to invite people to look at their life as an epic journey, an epic tale, a story that they're the main character in. And sometimes as the main character, you're the villain. Sometimes you're the hero. But that you're the main character in your story, and you need to be present with your life. So when we started our bike ride, we had not made contact with the place that we were going to end at. There's a Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. It's an art retreat center in upstate New York. We left at the Golden Gate Bridge because of the documentary, The Bridge, which is about people that have gone there to end their lives. So we wanted to begin at a place that was kind of synonymous with suicide. And we wanted to end at a place that was all about the power of art than how art can be used as a tool to heal. And so we ended at a place that we felt was like transcending pain. And so we hadn't made contact with them yet. We knew that we were going to go there. I called a few times. I got a little runaround from some of the people that worked there. I didn't expect to talk to Alex or Allison Gray at that moment. So we just said, let's go. We're going. If we get there and we never make contact, we'll just ride up on the last day. And we said, hey, we rode our bike 7,000 miles. And we did it for suicide awareness. And we were inspired by Alex's philosophy and art. Do you have a place we could rent, or can you tell us where we can go to get a hotel? You know, so when we were in San Francisco or Santa Cruz, we spoke with an organization called MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. All right. Alex Nelson's gray art is influenced by psychedelic journeys that they've taken. So when we were interviewing MAPS, so originally I wanted to shoot a film for this, but it just got too overwhelming. So I decided to write a book instead. But I was interviewing Brad Burge, who is kind of like the outreach coordinator for MAPS, and he's like, so you're going to the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors? I was like, yeah, that's our destination. He's like, so what did they say about your ride? And I was like, I don't know. They don't know that we're doing it. They're like, yeah, they don't know. I was like, I called a few times, but I didn't get any headway. And he's like, that's crazy. He's like, I know the Grays. I'm going to reach out to them for you. So by the time we got back to Phoenix, I finally got an email from Brad and from Allison Gray saying, like, we would love to have them. We're really supportive of their mission. And I'm going to put you in contact with our hospitality manager and event coordinator, Sharon Stelluto. And you just, anytime you need anything, you email her. So I would email Sharon once a month. I'm going to backtrack a little bit from this point, but remember, we made contact and it was because of MAPS. About 6 months before we left on our bike ride, I was in full advertisement mode and I was like handing out flyers. I made little cards to put in coffee shops. I'm exhausted. I got up all morning. I was making cold calls, calling different places about different mental health facilities across the country, getting them to like commit to like seeing us. And then I had to go to work and I was on my way home and I drove past this this coffee shop. And I was like, you know what? I got a stack. I drove right past it. I'd never been there before. And I was like, I got a stack of cards in my car. I'm just going to do a U-turn and I'm going to go back there. So I go in there and I'm trying to find a place to put like the stack of cards. There's nothing there. And the woman behind the counter, she's like, you want to leave something to advertise? I was like, yeah. She's like, yeah, we don't do that. The owner doesn't like that, but can I see what you're doing? So I hand her one of the cards. She's like, man, this is so important. You're riding your bike for suicide awareness. She's like, and you're going to where are you stopping at? And I told her we were going to end at the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. She's like, have you ever heard of MAPS? I was like, no, I've never heard of MAPS. She's like, would you like to come by? Like, maybe we'll talk like later this week. So I went and I chatted with her. And if it wasn't for her, I would have never known about MAPS to even call MAPS to set up a meeting with them. Now so that was just to me like one, like pay attention to your experiences in your life and recognizing the importance of one thing leading to another. It's very story. It's very narrative. Like, and there's like a magic that's in that, you know, the magic doesn't just happen in a book when we're reading the story about some fictional person or when we're watching a movie. It's happening in your life every single day. You just got to pay attention. So once a month, we're in contact with Chapel Sacred Mirrors and my contact is Sharon Stelluto. I email her once a month professionally just to say, hey, you haven't forgot about us, right? You haven't forgot about us. We're still on our way. And so the night before every big event, I would always call our contact and have like a 5-minute conversation. Well, when we were finally in Manhattan, and we were like 3 days away from finishing our bike ride, I called Sharon and we ended up having like an hour long phone conversation. we chatted as if we'd known each other for a long time. And I really liked the sound of her voice. I thought it was really pretty. So as soon as we got off the phone, I Google stalked her, and she was a looker. She not only had a pretty voice, she had a very pretty face. So when we got to Cosm, I was taken by her. And when I left, I gave her, we traded contact information, and I talked to her as I was traveling back home. I took some time to travel home, and Sharon and I started dating. And even though we were living in on the opposite sides of the country, and she's now my partner, and she lives out here. She moved out like 2 years after I met her, or 3 years after we met. But I just think that, like, there's something that, like, if I wouldn't have stopped in that coffee shop, I would have never been connected to MAPS, and MAPS wouldn't have connected me to the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, to and Chapel of Sacred Mirrors connecting me to Sharon, my future partner. Now, I say all of that, and another mess point of my another big message and theme in my book is the, when we have an experience, our ego needs to define it as positive or negative. That's just our, what we need to do to try to, like, make sense of it. But I argue that an experience is just an experience, and it's what we choose when we're able to learn from that experience. Now, how do I meet Sharon, who's 3,500 miles away, if my brother isn't dead? If my brother hadn't died by suicide, I'm not riding my bike across the country for suicide awareness in his honor. So a negative experience, something that we decide is negative, can lead to something that is super positive, just like something that we define as a positive experience can lead to a negative experience further down the road in the journey of our life. So I just invite people to look at their experiences that they're having. You're going to decide that you're going to, like, define it as positive or negative. Your ego is just going to do that. But if you can just be present enough to understand, like, what is the thing that I need to learn from this experience, and how do I grow stronger from it?
Wow. Yes, you answered my question. And thank you also, because I was listening to you, and I thank you for addressing also that none of this wouldn't have happened except that your brother had committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And what a shocking and heartbreaking and devastating thing to happen to anyone, to any family, to any brother, to any loved one. How devastating. I can't even imagine. Like, it's just, there aren't no words for something like that. But I'm listening to your story and hearing what you're saying, and it's like, it's this beautiful tapestry that's been woven in your life, and that these unexpected gifts or blessings or, I don't know, synchronicities.
Yeah. That's my big, I feel like synchronicity is the language of the cosmos.
Yes, absolutely. It's like, none of these things would have happened except your brother did the act that he did. It's kind of, all of these things were birthed out of that act. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
One thing leads to another. Everything is connected. And I think that we, when we train our brain to see the connections, or to just understand the importance how everything is connected, that it allows you to engage and participate in your own life on a different level.
Do you ever just sit back and think of your brother and are just gobsmacked by how what he did has just given birth to a whole new life for you, a whole new way of being?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's also a way that I still carry on a relationship with him, you know, like that act that he did altered the trajectory of my path. I know he didn't expect it, you know, when somebody is suffering from pain right there, they just want the pain to end. I don't believe that they want to die. I think they just want the pain to end, and they act impulsively, and they make a decision and an action that they can't take away.
And all of these unexpected, I don't know, I don't want to say consequences, but all of these unexpected gifts somehow emerge out of it.
But you have to, and the thing about it is that, like, it was a long journey for me to get the perspective that I have. Like, I had to deal with the grief and the trauma, and it was a long journey to get there. I promise that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Grief is not a straight line. It's a zigzag. So if you're lost in the darkness, just keep moving forward, and eventually you're going to turn around a bend, and there's going to be light that you'll see, and then move towards that light. It takes time. You have to give yourself the time. You have to be patient. You have to be empathetic with yourself and realize that, like, some days you'll feel great, and then on that 100th day in a row of feeling great, you're just going to cry for no reason. But just be patient and know that that's part of the process. And when you get to the point where you can allow yourself the space and time to understand the lessons of any given situation, no matter how horrible they are, that's a time when you empower yourself to learn and grow beyond the pain, and you're no longer a victim. You become in charge of your life.
Thank you everyone for listening to this interview with Thomas Brown and this very next episode of the podcast. For those of you who would like to know a little bit more about the work that Thomas is doing in the world, including his podcasts and his book, there will be a link in the episode's show notes. Please do know that suicide is a very real issue here in the States. But there are plenty of people and institutions who are working very hard to ensure that more human beings do not lose their lives in this way. There will be a couple of links in the episode's show notes for you to access help for yourself or a loved one around this subject. Thank you so much for listening to these episodes. I know that some episodes are more challenging than others, but I do think it's important to have these conversations. And just as a side note, there's a little bit of an Easter egg after the end of this intro, so be sure to check that out. Thank you to everyone who listens, and thanks to all of you who subscribe to the YouTube channel. You'll never know how much it means to me. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Thomas. Understand that this world is full of ups and downs, of positives and negatives. Last week, I went to church with a friend, and the subject was grace. And in the conversational part of the service, when we broke up into small groups, I brought up dark grace, which a lot of people don't talk about. And I brought in a quotation from Shakespeare. There is nothing good or bad, only thinking makes it so. And so I want all of us to sit with that, that in this world, things that we think are negative or things that we think are beautiful and positive, yes, they may be that in that moment, but as time goes on and as life unfolds, maybe the meaning around them changes. Maybe we only understand a fraction of what is happening in that moment, and something that breaks our hearts might lead to something beautiful later on. So be like Thomas and understand that. Understand that dark grace exists and that it's here for us. That these things are not happening to us, but for us. And I suspect that very soon, you'll understand that this world, it's a gorgeous place, and it has your back, and it only wants the best for each and every single one of us. Thank you so much. I know that you don't feel this way, but I don't want you to think that I'm saying your brother committing suicide was a good thing. Please don't.
No, I don't. I don't. No, I don't. Okay. I don't. I know what you're getting at.
Yeah. It's like this unexpected, strange unraveling of events that you could have never foreseen when it happened. Or even I'm sure 5 years later, when you went on that walk, you could have never foretold the way life was going to unspool and all of these gorgeous things were going to happen for you.
If I was a fictional character in a book, we can just say that that was an inciting incident.
Yes. Absolutely.